A word of warning. This podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes strong language. It therefore may be unsuitable for our young listeners or other people who may find it disturbing. Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast, bringing you high-profile and under-the-radar cases from across the country every week. Today is December 12th, 2019. I'm Owen Michael. With me is Lonnie Coombs. Hello, Lonnie. Nice
Hello.
To see you again.
Good to see you.
Lonnie's a legal analyst and former Los Angeles County criminal prosecutor who's covered cases including the trials of Casey Anthony, Jody Arias, and George Zimmerman, among many others. It's great to have you back. Last time you were here, we kind of talked about your Oxygen documentary series, Death at the Mansion, about the Rebecca Zahau case in San Diego, as well as the show Final Appeal with Brian Banks.
Yeah.
How's that going?
Good. Right now I've been working on a couple other cases that will be on Oxygen. Been on the road in Virginia and Atlanta and Fort Worth, digging into cold cases.
Similar type of stuff.
Yes.
How is it going?
Good. Good. Very interesting cases. And, you know, traveling across the country, you see all different levels and types of prosecutions and law enforcement. And it's interesting to see it.
Well, good. Glad to have you back. Let's get into our cases this
okay.
week. We've got, for this week, we've got a Florida man accused of murdering his wife is also in trouble for legal shenanigans after allegedly hiding money and failing to hire a lawyer once his public defender was dismissed. A lot to get into on that one. We've got an illegal cross-country road race has the winner rethinking his public statements on the caper. But first, a shocking case out of Alabama. Lonnie, can you tell us some details, what we know so far about this developing case out of Birmingham, Alabama, about the kidnapping and murder case of Camille Cupcake McKinney?
Yeah, this is such a tragic case and really horrific for everyone out there because we're talking about a three-year-old little girl as the victim. Camille, I guess she went by the name Cupcake McKinney, and apparently she was at an outdoor birthday party on Saturday, October 12th, you know, as lots of little children are at that age. And that was the place that she was last seen. She disappeared. And there was a massive search for her. The FBI got involved, the U.S. Marshals, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, Crime Stoppers. I mean, everybody just converged on this because we're talking about a three-year-old little girl essentially disappearing in broad daylight with a lot of people around. And people started putting up money for rewards. It got up to $20,000. They got over 400 tips. Unfortunately, 10 days later, they found her body in a dumpster that was taken to a landfill, and essentially they found her decomposed body. So two people were arrested, Patrick Stallworth and his girlfriend, 29-year-old Derek Brown. They were both charged with capital murder for a child under 14 years old, and they could face the death penalty if they're convicted. This week was the preliminary hearing. So in Alabama, the case first goes to a preliminary hearing in front of a judge, and the judge decides if there's enough probable cause for the case to be put then in front of the grand jury for an indictment. And at first they were supposed to be done together in the preliminary hearing, but then the judge allowed them to split up. So it's just Stallworth who was going first. And at this point is where you really get to hear the evidence that the prosecution has, because it's like a mini trial that they put in front of the judge. And so a lot of details came out that people hadn't known about yet. Very sad details. And essentially they put up a timeline by the lead homicide detective who testified for 2.5 hours. And essentially on that day at 12:02 p.m., they have on surveillance video, they have Stallworth going into a Shell station buying almost $19 worth of candy. This is near the Tom Brown Village where the party was going on. Then about 5 minutes later, two preteen girls were leaving cheerleading practice, and they said that Stallworth and Brown approached them in a blue SUV. And Stallworth was said to them, "I'm looking for a girl that looks like you," and then offered them candy. And those girls got nervous, and so they took off. And there's video, security video of that, but you can't really see the occupants in the car. So it's interesting how the timeline is set up here by all of these different video cameras all over. Other kids told the police that they also saw a man in a blue SUV who was handing out candy to children there in this housing community. And eventually we come to Camille, who got into the van. There was a 10-year-old little boy who said he saw her go with the people and that she was crying. And there's another video that shows a man talking to two small children. One of them is Camille, and that eventually she walks off with them. So when Stallworth was first detained, he consented to let the police search his cell phone. And they found child pornography on his phone. Nothing with Camille, but child pornography. So they filed some charges against him. And he essentially told them, look, I was there in that area. I did buy candy, but I know nothing about this little girl. I had nothing to do with it. And then they did track his cell phone. And that time when she was abducted, there was a lot of movement between the Woodside condos and the Parkway Villa apartments. And eventually, according to the detective, Brown, the girlfriend, told the police about a construction trash dumpster that was at the Parkway Villas. And they followed up on that and they searched the dumpster. And that's where they found Camilla's body.
So maybe you could explain this. You just said that the judge allowed them to do this separately. And I'm curious as to whether, is that, whose advantage is that? Because wouldn't it be better for them to be, not necessarily have a united front, but isn't that worse for both of them if they do it separately? Because it does appear that the lawyers are basically saying, no, it was him. And she's saying it was him. And he's saying, no, it was her.
Absolutely.
Whereas if they would have stuck together, then, I mean, I'm not sure. What does that indicate to you?
Well, it's actually... a great thing when there's two defendants, they usually split up. There's no such thing as a united front.
Divide and conquer
exactly.
is always the way to go.
You've got somebody you can point the finger at. Now, the preliminary hearing is just in front of a judge, but when you get to a jury, you're sitting there and you can make your cohort into the biggest monster in the world who was abusing you and forcing you to do things you didn't want to do. And you were just, you know, this helpless little victim yourself. And you're there in front of the jury. They see you as a human being. They might start to empathize with you. They might feel sympathetic for you. And they can just say, oh, it was the big bad monster that we don't really know who's not in the courtroom. So it's a big advantage to any defendant who has a co-defendant where they can point the finger. And as you see going through this evidence, you know, that he's going to keep pointing the finger at Brown, at his girlfriend. So you see Brown's the one who told them where the body was.
Right.
Of course, Brown's going to say something very different in her preliminary hearing, right? And then the autopsy came up and said that she died from asphyxiation by suffocation. And this was something new that nobody had heard, she had toxic levels of methamphetamine and trazodone, which is an antidepressant used to treat insomnia. Now, interestingly, the trazodone is Stallworth's. He has a prescription for that. But in the preliminary hearing, his defense attorney said that, well, it's actually Brown who uses meth and likes to mix it with the trazodone because she likes the way it makes her feel. And so she was stealing this from Stallworth. And that's who was using that combination. And Stallworth only uses marijuana. So pointing the finger again at Brown. So the second time Stallworth talks to police, he says, look, I want to tell you, you know, what happened. I did see Camille that night for the very first time. Where I saw her was in our apartment. I came home. My girlfriend was there. Camille was sitting on the couch with her. And I said, wait a minute, that's not your kid. And she said, I want to keep her. And, you know, why don't you do something sexual with her? And Stallworth says
that's
that
he's... This is
all his story.
Exactly.
And he goes, oh, no, I don't want to have anything to do with this. And he says he goes outside and smokes a cigarette. And then later at some point, his girlfriend ends up, you know, playing with the little girl, taking her clothes off, taking her barrettes out, giving her a bath. And then at some point, he says that the girlfriend puts her hands over Camille's nose and mouth. And then Camille is asleep. That's the way he describes it. Next thing he remembers, he wakes up the next morning in bed and his girlfriend is in bed with him. And that's really all he remembers. The police also tested a plastic cover that had been on a mattress in the living room and they found blood on it. And there was DNA from Stallworth, Brown, and Camille.
So the Stallworth and Brown, obviously, that's nothing to see here because they both live in this domicile, or at least are there often enough that that wouldn't be enough. But how the heck does Camille's DNA get in on this?
Yeah.
We should say that they said as well this week that according to DNA analysis, they haven't found anything on her body that would indicate sexual assault. But they also said she was decomposed enough that there could have been any evidence like that could potentially have been deteriorated. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. So the defense made a big deal about this. Hey, look, they swabbed her in all the areas of her body where you would think there'd be DNA from a sexual assault. There was nothing, so she wasn't sexually assaulted. And the prosecution said, no, no, you can't make that conclusion. She was so decomposed.
It's 10 days later and,
exactly.
it's in garbage, you know,
exactly.
ostensibly if she's found in the dumpster. So I'm sure a forensic analysis or a forensic expert from another side of this could probably dispose of that theory. Yeah. That's definitely not locked in as far as that goes.
Exactly. And that's what the judge said. I mean, the defense said, look, there's not enough here for probable cause to say he's the one who did it. The judge said, no, there's plenty here. It's going to go forward to the grand jury.
From state to state, that's fairly common as far as capital murder. And in other words, you have a preliminary hearing and it goes to a grand jury before it goes to an actual full criminal case. Is that accurate?
It's a little bit different in some places. Like in California, you can either do a preliminary hearing or a grand jury. They essentially perform the same function. And if they both find that there's enough probable cause, then it goes to trial. But here in Alabama, it's kind of interesting. It goes first to the preliminary hearing and then to the grand jury who indicts, essentially decides the formal charges, and then goes to the trial.
Which seems to me an extra fail-safe, but mm-hmm. is that excess? Do you have an opinion about that legally, or does the legal community at large say, like, that's just an extra hurdle and you'd prefer to sort of take it straight to the grand jury versus a preliminary hearing? I mean, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, the joke has always been that a grand jury will, you know, indict a ham sandwich. Mm-hmm. So as far as a fail-safe, it's not like it's a really probing investigation where they're going to say, oh, no, we don't see a lot here. Because a grand jury, it's done with just a prosecutor mm-hmm. and witnesses, no judge.
Right.
Right.
And there's not a defense attorney.
There's no defense attorney in there.
They're not presenting. They're just saying, here's some stuff that we found.
Right.
We think this is enough. What do you think? And that's the ham sandwich.
Yeah.
Right. And as you say, they both face the death penalty if convicted. It seems to me that with that extra step of the preliminary hearing, that's if you are convicted through this process, then that's an extra sort of fail-safe, at least abstractly.
Yeah, the preliminary hearing really is, because it's in front of a judge. A lot of times, if the defense doesn't feel like they have a lot, they won't put anything on. It is just sort of, a formality. But mm-hmm. a lot of times, if the defense says, really believes that this is either a weak case or that the guy's not guilty, they will put on a full case in front of the judge, hoping that the judge will see through this and, have the courage to say,
Which seems maybe to be the case here. We should say this is Thursday, the 12th, and tomorrow, Derek Brown, the girlfriend is, I believe, scheduled to be in front of the judge and make their case on that. So we'll see. There could be further fireworks.
That's right. And the other strategy here we've got to remember is there's a lot of media attention on this. Mm-hmm. So even if the defense didn't think they were going to sway the judge, this is the time they're playing to those potential jurors. They want to put out, their side of the story as many times as they can.
What's the rule in Alabama or even state to state as far as do you have, if you're playing to the media, is it unethical or is this just part of the process? I mean, these hearings are public, right?
Yeah. So the grand jury isn't, but a preliminary hearing is.
The preliminary hearing, mm-hmm. anybody can sit in on mm-hmm. this. So all these reporters, in fact, national now, as we're saying, they're sitting in there so they can do this. And so that's to the benefit of, well, who knows whose benefit it is here, but if it's at this level, then the defense, you want your attorney to sort of use that if possible.
Absolutely, because the prosecution's putting in a lot of information here, too, that they probably didn't need to put in front of a judge to get it over the standard of probable cause, but they're putting in a lot of juicy details in here. So they're using that opportunity also.
But even in the court of public opinion, as to use the hackneyed term, even if you've got all that stuff and you're sort of swaying the public and you think you're winning it this way, that doesn't really necessarily sway the case much, does it? Because ostensibly in a jury trial, the jury's sequestered from this public information. Hopefully they don't know too much about the background of the case in jury selection. And in the impartial thing, who cares what the public says? This is the thing. What do you think about that?
I think that especially in this day and age, if it's a big case like this one,
it's going to seep in.
People know about it. And apparently the community's got very involved to help try and find this little girl, because everyone was so outraged that one of their, you have to protect your own children, right? Everybody gets on board for that. And so a lot of times, very rarely are juries sequestered. And even if they are sequestered, that media stuff is out there more than ever. Being able to get it on your phone, get it on your computer. You don't have to just listen to the news at night to get, the update.
So I guess maybe that's sort of a misconception. And, us lay people watch Law & Order for however long. And, we hear about the high profile stuff. But I guess abstractly, I'm thinking most juries are sequestered, and yet they're not. I haven't been on a jury trial myself.
Interesting.
Not yet. I actually am looking forward to it.
You put it out there. You're going to start getting juries coming now. That's
exactly
what happens.
That's fine. I'm ready to do my civic duty. Absolutely. I've got the time.
You would find it fascinating.
I agree.
Seriously. I mean, I wish I could sit on a jury, because being in the jury room is such a unique experience. And it's, you know, unless you've done it yourself.
My mom was a foreman. She got elected to be foreman I forget what kind of, I think it was a fatal DUI case in Florida. I believe it was in the Miami area. But yeah, she was not particularly interested in being the forewoman, but hence why she got chosen for that. So that's even one more step.
So she thinks she got chosen because she had no interest in it.
She was the reluctant leader it, I suppose. And, you know, she's a fairly fair-minded person or whatever. So, you know, obviously I'm a little biased on that, but, you know, it was what it was. And I think it only lasted just maybe 3 or 4 days or something like that.
Oh,
but you're right. She wasn't sequestered. You know, I think she went home every day.
It's very expensive to sequester a jury, and it's a huge imposition on the jurors. You know, you're not getting to go to home. You're not with your family.
Sure.
You can't do child care.
Could be weeks at a time.
That's right.
And isn't the... It almost seems, well, I guess we only hear the high profile stuff, but it seems that much more. Every time you hear about this stuff, it is always you're hearing about it in the course of a mistrial, because somebody did get a newspaper or you know, they snuck a phone in or they watched TV or something like that. So
yeah,
that's some fascinating stuff.
There's also a theory that, you know, because the jurors hate it, that they start to get a bias against the prosecutor, because they feel like it's the prosecutor that is making this whole thing happen and, you know, and making their lives horrible.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's not for everybody to be put up in a hotel and do the thing, although it doesn't sound terrible to me, but, you know, that's not to be disrespectful to the system.
Yeah, it's not as funny as you would think. I mean, you're on a schedule. You're told when to wake up. You're told when you can eat, what you can eat. I mean, it is,
you can't watch TV. Your per diem is like $14 a day or something
like
that.
It's pretty
minuscule compared to, you know, especially if you're, you know, a bartender or a cab driver or something like that, where you're losing money every day. So anyway, as we say, this is developing, and we will have more details on truecrimedaily.com as this thing develops. More to come for sure.
So next up, we've got the case of David Tronis out of Orlando. Owen, you want to tell us about this Florida man case?
Yeah. So this, I have a lot of questions for you legally on this case. There's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of details here. I'll try to get to all of them as accurately as I can. David Tronis is a 51-year-old Orlando, Florida man. He's arrested in August of last year, 2018. He's charged with first-degree murder in the death of his wife, Shanti Cooper Tronis, who was 39 when she was killed on April 24th, 2018. Police alleged that he killed his wife in their Delaney Park, which is a neighborhood within Orlando. It's a fairly nice house. Medical examiner ruled that she died from blunt force trauma and strangulation. Tronis told police that he found his wife unconscious in the bathtub, and that she had fallen in the tub. He found her there, tried to revive her, and then called police. Police, however, say that Tronis had gone out walking. First, they accuse him of actually beating her and strangling her to death. The medical examiner found that she had died from blunt force trauma and strangulation. Police say that David Tronis had gone out and walked the dogs. He went for a walk. He was doing housework for hours before calling police. That's their contention. He has pleaded not guilty to murder. So a lot going on here. WFTV reports that 2 days after after his wife died, David transferred $252,000 from her bank accounts to his own legal representation. 10 days after that, he transferred their house from a shared trust to himself. Shanti's first husband has custody of the couple's of their son. So he became a state administrator weeks after that. So some of this stuff is Florida state law and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm trying to figure that stuff out. In a court filing, though, he said that he thought the asset transfers that David had done were obtained by fraud. There was two life insurance policies that he claims they were obtained by fraud and or forgery. And he said that Tronis had tried to collect on one of the policies about a week before he was arrested for his wife's murder, which was a couple months after she died. Ex-husband also alleges that Tronis conspired with Tronis' own ex-wife to get this money. Those details remain to be seen. We'll get to those if we learn more. But so here's kind of some of the stuff that goes legally sideways. Tronis had paid a defense attorney $250,000 for representation last year. It was around November or so. He gave $250,000 to this law firm for his defense, but he couldn't continue to pay into this year. That attorney requested to withdraw from the case in April over a conflict of interest, telling the judge it was, quotes, due to privileged information after that law firm received the homicide report from police, according to the Orlando Sentinel. So two things happening here. Trinas claimed that he gave all his money to legal defense. Then he ran out of money. And then he said he was before the judge, and the judge asked him, do you want to hire another attorney? No, sir, I can't. I'm broke. It looks like I'm going to have to get public representation. So the judge assigned him a public defender. And then as well, the withdrawal from the original law firm, according to due to privileged information after receiving the homicide report, what does that indicate to you? Privileged information is the whole kit and caboodle when you're a defense attorney, right?
Yeah.
And even if you're a defense attorney and my client tells me, yeah, I did the murder, blah, 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 I'm giving you all the details. I mean, I watch too much TV, but essentially, if you're a lawyer and if I'm your defense attorney, I hear that information, I can't do anything with that.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is speculation here.
Yeah.
What do you think of what's happening
there? So this is total speculation, but there are a couple things that, you know, reading between the lines, I'm looking at. One is, Trinas paid, you know, $250,000 here for defense representation, and they didn't represent him that long.
No, that's a lot of money for a high profile, high powered attorney.
Yeah,
you got basically 3 months out of it, or 4 months out of it, maybe.
And
only one court appearance, or maybe two. It's unclear on that. But
and all of a sudden he's saying, you know, I don't have enough money to pay him more. I mean, I would think that you'd get at least, you know, a few more appearances out of that.
Yeah,
maybe the
courtesy.
Trial. Right. So it seems like there's sort of a personality conflict going on, which happens a lot between, you know, defense attorneys and clients, especially if they're a strong-headed client. The other thing, too, though, is this thing about after receiving, you know, the homicide report and due to privileged information, I don't know if this is true or not, but sometimes if, as you're talking about the defense and the client, the defendant is adamant that they want to do something where they're going to get up on the stand and lie, and the attorney knows about it, they can't suborn perjury. So if they don't want that to happen, and for some reason they feel like they can't control their client, they can't stop them from doing it, you know, they can ask to withdraw. So it might be something like that, but I don't know.
And when we're talking about suborning perjury, you're saying actively allowing it or encouraging a perjury to happen. So even though I'm a passive person, I'm the defense attorney, and I'm saying, no, you really shouldn't do that, but I know that you're going to do that, even though I'm telling you not to, that's still suborning because I have knowledge that you are going to do that?
Well, what you can do is you can just say, you can go up ahead and take the stand and testify and say what you want to say, and I'm just not going to say a word.
Mm-hmm.
I
have no questions for my client.
That's exactly right. I'm not saying one way or another, but that also sort of signals to the jury there's something going on.
Everybody in the room understands that, boy, you're taking a dive here.
Yeah.
You're tanking this purpose. So there's also, speaking of which, as you say, the $250,000 didn't get you much with this law firm, but there was an additional $30,000. The prosecutors say Trinas gave the same law firm that wasn't disclosed, that they found out about later.
Mm-hmm.
The attorney says that money, it didn't go to us. It was basically going to a legal trust, just in case. You know, we've got this separate container that we put this $30,000 in there. But you're right. So they gave the $30,000 back to him. So now, by the way, they didn't give it to him. They put it back to the estate that this whole the dispute is about. So all sorts of shady money movement and that kind of thing.
And honestly, you're not sure from who. I mean, you know, everybody might not have clean hands in this. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I won't speculate about Florida, but a month later.
I'm not saying anything. I'm not suborning anything.
Exactly.
Right now.
That was unfair on my behalf. I apologize to all Floridians. A month after that, the judge did appoint a public defender for Trinas. And then in June, after this stuff came to light, the judge then vacated the order for the public defender because he said, it turns out you probably do have enough money to do this.
Right, because the Florida standard for indigent status is
$24,980. Basically, if you make $25,000, you're too broke to hire a lawyer, and they'll do that.
Yeah.
You know.
No, if you make $25,000, you can't get a public defender. You have to make less than that. Right.
So, and I had a question about this too, and I wonder whether this is state to state. Can't I even though I make more than 25 grand a year, can't I opt to take the public defender?
Well, you can do that here, but then they will charge you. And they'll prorate it.
Really?
Yes. You don't get it. I mean, you have the right to counsel, but as far as the public defender,
no kidding.
You're going to have to pay for them if you have a certain amount of money.
I don't know if that's widely known, and maybe that's just my own bias, but I guess I thought everybody thinks that if you have a public defender, basically you're getting pro bono legal work there. But yeah,
depends on how much you make.
It's a sliding scale, huh?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Interesting. And the judge will usually say that, like, I don't think I have enough money. And they'll say, well, okay, I'll give you a public defender for now, but we're going to do an accounting. Mm-hmm. And if you're making more than that, then you'll have to pay.
Is it a percentage or is it case by case? I wonder about that because it still might be cheaper to get a public defender and, ostensibly they're on the same legal footing.
Yeah.
They may have fewer resources, obviously, than a private law firm, et cetera.
But I'll tell you this, as far as public defenders, they get a bad rap, but public defenders are in that courtroom every day. Mm-hmm. They know the judge, they know the clerk, they know the prosecutor. They've worked together a lot. So if you're hoping to just sort of like, somebody who really knows that system, that courtroom, and can probably get you a fairly good deal, it's not a bad idea to consider going with a public defender.
Yeah, I have a friend of a friend in Memphis who's a public defender, and he's a busy guy, and boy, he does it for the passion of it. I mean,
yes.
he's absolutely in it for all the right reasons, and it's it's not about money or anything like that. He's working hard.
That's right. And there's a lot of really good ones.
Yeah, I was impressed that really the guy cares a lot, and I can't see how you would get into that. Especially considering you could certainly make a lot of money in the private sector.
That's
if you
right.
decided to do this. It's sort of a noble calling as it goes. So further shenanigans here, alleged shenanigans. The Orlando Sentinel also reports that the prosecutors allege Tronis hid another $123,527 in the accounts of a limited liability corporation he had created weeks before he was arrested. I've been looking vaguely familiar with this kind of stuff, but it's fairly easy to create a limited liability corporation, go into LegalZoom or you go into one of these things. And it sort of indicates to a layperson that there's a presence of mind. But on the other hand, if I'm a decent lawyer, like there's nothing legal about opening up a trust or opening up an LLC and, I'm just investing some money when I want to go into business after this or whatever the case was. But this is also in the context of claiming to be indigent, et cetera.
Yeah.
So the judge referred the matter to the state's attorney's office in Florida to investigate the fraud, this alleged fraud, and to recover any taxpayer money that was used in the public defense, as you indicated there. Orange Osceola State Attorney's Office has stated that they'll begin the investigation after the murder trial is complete, which brings us to this week. Tronis appeared before the judge this week and said that he has still not hired an attorney.
See, he's just one of these obstreperous people. He just doesn't want to go along with the program here.
Putting a red flag in front of the bull kind of thing,
Well, it's kind of stupid because judges, they want their courtrooms to run efficiently.
Yeah.
And the last thing I would think a defendant would want is that judge to be irritated at you. And if you're clogging up his courtroom and thinking that you're going to get your trial put off more and more just because you're not hiring an attorney when the judge told you to.
It's the first time I've ever heard something like that where you're like, you have to do that. No, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I just refuse to do that.
Yeah.
It's unclear exactly. They said he's in contact with an attorney, but that attorney has not decided whether to take the case or not, according to the Orlando Sentinel, which speaks to what you're saying. This client may just be a really difficult person when we consider the previous withdrawal from the other law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy or this person or this firm is sort of like, I don't know about this. I wonder if obviously pure speculation. If I know I did it and I know the case is stacked against me, et cetera, then all I can do is play for time. So I might as well. But he's also being held this entire time too.
Yeah.
But I guess county is better than prison, et cetera.
That's what they say.
As I say, it's speculation. And as you said, the prosecutor himself, they think that it's an attempt to delay the trial. The judge has scheduled a January 3rd hearing to rule on Tronis's legal representation. The judge did not change the date. The murder trial is set to begin, which is January 21st, which is basically 6 weeks from now. So it's really kind of compressing this entire thing here. And like I said, it seems like you're really taunting everybody involved here.
Well, the judge is trying to play hardball and give him a deadline, right? to force them to get on the ball here.
So at a January 3rd hearing like this, that's basically, it's just a repeat of the thing. Mr. Tronis, have you hired a counsel? No, Your Honor, I'm still looking. Okay, you know what? Then what?
So the January 3rd, it's about 3 weeks before the trial is set, right? So if he's not gotten an attorney, the judge might say, okay, I'm going to assign you another attorney, but you're going to have to pay for him eventually, you know? And then that way they have enough time to prepare for the trial because he wants to start that trial.
Really shooting yourself in the foot, though, because if you've got a brand new representation here, you only have now 3 weeks to get into it.
That's
versus
right.
This entire, you had basically, this is the second year now
that
you had all this time that you could have prepared for this.
But you know, the other thing about this guy too, you know, we find out that he has been holding on to some of this evidence.
Right.
I mean, you've got, so apparently the prosecutors just said that they had some new evidence, these bloody sheets that were taken from the home where Ashanti was found dead. And the defense has been holding on to it. A private investigator working for the defense, Billy Lane, had been holding on to the bloody sheets for nearly a year without disclosing the evidence to police or prosecutors.
Huge.
Extremely unusual.
Who's on the hook for that? The private investigator, probably, or they can say, I was dumb, I didn't know. It was actually the defense team that told me to do this, or who's on the hook for that?
Well, here's the thing.
Can you play dumb on that?
No, you can't play dumb on that.
I didn't know what I had.
A private investigator, well, I don't know about that. I mean, a private investigator should know what it is, right? They should be asking, what is this? It's bloody sheets. I mean, come on.
Obviously.
You know, that's going to be something important for somebody.
No, they were maroon sheets, Your Honor, and I didn't know that there was a blood stain on them because they were black sheets or something.
Not a very good private investigator.
I mean, right. But it seems nobody involved on this side of the thing here is doing this particularly well.
Right.
So I wonder about that. But yeah, that's a huge detail, and thank you for bringing that up because that's a huge thing. But again, does the judge or does the prosecution then say, all right, we're going to go after you separately for obstructing justice? Would that be?
Well, here's the interesting thing, because I'm not seeing anything about that. No mention of, you know, the prosecutors being really mad. They're just saying, hey, we've got this new evidence. It's been tested and here's what we found. So there's a thing called discovery. So the prosecutor has to disclose all their evidence to the defense, right? Because they're the prosecutors, they're the ones bringing the charges. It used to be that the defense could kind of sit and hide the ball until trial and spring all these surprises on the prosecution. But thank heavens, through the years, it kind of evolved to reciprocal discovery, is what it's called, where once the prosecution discloses their evidence to the defense has a reasonable amount of time where they then have to disclose to the prosecution what they're planning to put on for their trial evidence. You know, witnesses, experts, physical evidence, which this would obviously be. But they didn't do that here. Okay, so what is the punishment if you don't follow through on that? Well, a lot of times it's that you bar that evidence from coming in. But based on this, the results
this
that they
helps.
Got,
this would help
the
prosecution.
Prosecutor wants it. Yeah. Exactly. So that might be why they're not doing anything about it. But the other thing is, because it was being held on by this private investigator, we don't know if it's been contaminated or not. Yeah.
Right.
And it actually kind of goes back and forth because I guess there was a fitted sheet and a top sheet. And on the fitted sheet, they found DNA of David and Shanti, right? And on the top sheet, it's David and an unknown male. So that could be used by the defense to say, hey, look, there's this unknown male who came in and killed her.
There's a sort of an speaking of that, there's an unrelated detail that basically the ex-husband of Shanti alleges this, and police have commented on this as well, that case evidence reportedly shows that Tronis went to a gay men's bathhouse the day after he got married to Shanti. And the ex-husband alleges that Tronis had frequent gay activity during marriage. That's obviously that's his public statement. We have no proof of that one way or the other, but that's yet another wrinkle, as far as, forgive the expression, but as far as that goes. Yeah, I mean, really just kind of a messed up case, and I wouldn't want to be defense on this.
No. And I'm sure the prosecutors.
I get that.
Yeah.
I get wanting to kind of pull out of this thing. Like, this is a mess. This is a sure loser. Speculating, of course.
Yes. Yeah. You never know. I'm telling you, you never know with trials and things like that. But he's doing everything he can to really.
I mean, we have these conceptions of how Florida is, and it's the Florida man thing and all that kind of stuff. But by your estimation, you've got some experience with state to state prosecution and legal systems and stuff. Is it kind of the Wild West, or is this? it seems that there's an inordinate amount of crazy stuff that you hear out of Florida, but is that just the high profile stuff coming up to the top? Or do you find that it's, in your semi-professional opinion, that's sort of like a wilder kind of a scene out there legally?
You know, this is pure speculation because I have not done it. But it does. I don't know if it's the media just picks up on them more and focuses on them more, but there's by far a higher percentage of crazy cases reported about from Florida than any other case. Every time you hear about a crazy case in the media, it's a Florida case.
Usually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I deal with it every day.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, there's crazy cases in California and in every state, but not to the level that you see in the media coming from Florida.
I mean, you know, you have one-offs all over the place. There's, you know, sensational stuff. I mean, part of that, I've spent a lot of time in Florida myself, Miami and South Florida and that kind of stuff. It's a wild, woolly, international kind of crazy type of place. And it definitely attracts a certain amount of characters, people that like the lifestyle or people trying to get off the grid. Or for whatever reason, Florida has certain laws that others don't as far as disclosure and things like that. So, yeah. And again, no disrespect to the state, but it always does seem that they got some high profile stuff here. Of course, I'm certainly throwing fuel on the fire here by bringing up a Florida case in this thing. So I'm looking in the mirror. So I have another couple of legal questions about this next story. This is about a cross-country road race and public comments by the winner. So some of our viewers of a certain age may remember a movie from 1981 called The Cannonball Run. It was a movie starring Burt Reynolds and Dom DeLuise, and it is a huge celebrity cast from the 70s and 80s. When I was a kid, I watched it. I loved it. I've seen parts of it since then. There's some problematic stuff, that the politically correct stuff that it was best left in the 80s. However, it's the movie's about an illegal cross-country road race from New York to L.A. It's based on an actual underground sort of race that was actually happening in real life, called the Cannonball Baker Sea to Shining Sea Memorial Trophy Dash, that began in the 70s, and it's sort of underground. There's no real rules. It's just, here's your starting mark, here's your ending mark. Whoever gets there first gets the prize. It's highly illegal, obviously, because it's a lot of speeding and that kind of stuff. So they're still doing it. I was unaware of this. I've heard of other stuff, the Gumball Rally and other cross-country races like this, but I was surprised to see that they're still doing this. So this year they did it again.
Now, is it a race where a bunch of cars all start at once and go, or is it just one car doing it time-wise?
As you may imagine, nobody's real clear on what the what the details are
secrecy.
On that. In the movie, it was everybody starts, basically, they're all in a line, and, you know, they do a punch card, basically, and, you know, then you're up and punch card, and then you're up, and then, and then they go. It's unclear these days how that's done. Obviously, they're not going with a whole lot of details on this. The guy that won it this year is an Ohio man. His name is Doug Tabbitt, and his driving partner, Arnie Toman. They won the unsanctioned race this year. So they drove from Manhattan, basically downtown New York City, to Redondo Beach, which is the South Bay here in Los Angeles. By the way, tough to get to Redondo Beach. It's not like going to downtown.
Yeah.
It's tough to get there. So New York to Los Angeles in 27 hours, 25 minutes, which is a new record.
That's crazy.
It's insane to me that you can do that drive in one day. Reaching speeds of about 180 miles per hour, they allegedly got there 10 times. They averaged about 103 miles an hour.
Can you imagine averaging 103 miles an hour for 25 hours?
Right.
That's crazy.
I would like to imagine. I mean, I'm a thrill seeker. That sounds like a lot of fun, but, you know, more maybe in the veins of like a 24-hour Le Mans race where it's a closed track or something like that.
Yes.
They allegedly took steps. Not just against law enforcement, but they had various things. They were watching for like deer crossing the roadway and things like that. And they've taken pains to talk about how safe, all these safety measures they took. And even like the guy's wife hates that he does this, but, you know, somehow he's said, you know, honey, it's okay. Being extra safe, we're wearing helmets. They weren't wearing helmets.
No. Well, they had this souped up car that they then changed so that law enforcement would not realize what they were driving.
It's pretty ingenious. So, yeah, and by the way, this is 2,825 miles in 27 hours. It's insane. It's basically, yeah. So as you say, it's a souped up 2015 Mercedes AMG sedan, which is a fairly, you know, it's a sporty sedan, but it's not over the top. They had a boosted engine with 700 horsepower, which is huge, a 45-gallon auxiliary gas tank, an extra gas tank with so they went about 600 miles before refueling. That's pretty great. Use that in LA. They had a police scanner in it. They had high-tech radar detectors and radar deflectors, apparently, that could basically make themselves invisible to the radar signals. They had thermal scopes, as I said, to look for speed traps, cops on the side of the road, deer all the way ahead. The two co-pilots were driving the front, and there's a guy, they have a spotter riding with them in the back with the high-tech binoculars. You could see down the road 2 miles for 2 miles, and it stabilized the whole thing. And as you say, they took off the markings of the car. They took the Mercedes off it, the logos, the emblems. They basically painted it a nondescript color. They didn't want to be flashy, obviously.
They changed, like, the taillights.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
In the movie, and it's... In the movie, there was like a Lamborghini Countach, and there was a, you know, there was like a DeLorean, I think. There was an ambulance. There was all these souped up cars, and then there was a couple of them that were kind of stealthy like this. These guys went with the stealth thing, and they had lookouts, the whole thing. It was a very organized situation. And they gave a couple of interviews. The guy, Doug Tabbitt, who won this thing, gave interviews after winning, and talked to Road and Track, talked to Cleveland Plain Dealer. This is an Ohio guy. Mm-hmm. Talked to Cleveland.com, gave an interview. This obviously made international headlines. And he says, now this week, I maybe shouldn't have done this. I'm getting more media attention than I thought. So he even said that some cops had congratulated him, and, you know, they had their scrapes. Also, we should say, safety-wise, reportedly, only a broken arm is the only injury that any racers have suffered in this 40-year history, you know, who's to say, but that's what they claim. What the heck? Mm-hmm. If I'm a prosecutor in any of these states or a prosecutor in Ohio, the guy's on record saying we did this. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me the case could be made if you really wanted to. I mean, maybe it's a little bit, I don't know, not worth the time, but if you're sort of speaking of putting a red flag in front of a bull kind of thing, yeah. It's like, well, you're a little bit thumbing your nose, you're a little bit taunting, yeah, all these jurisdictions that you went through, especially the Midwest states and stuff like that, where, you know, I've been through some of those states. They don't like speeding. And
that's right.
You know,
from outsiders.
Right. And it seems to me that there's probably some surveillance video somewhere on along a 3,000-mile trek here.
Absolutely.
There's got to be this stuff. So what are your thoughts on that? As a former prosecutor,
yeah,
what would you think?
Here's the problem with this. You know, as a prosecutor, you deal with a lot of vehicular deaths. And when I hear that somebody went 103 miles for 27 hours, 123 miles per hour. Yeah, and got up to 180.
What's 200 miles an hour? That's,
yeah,
insane.
It's insane. Now, on the one hand, I'm thinking, wow, I love all the preparation they took and all the things that they were meticulous in their planning, yeah, and thinking of every little detail. But then I'm thinking, how many dead bodies there could have been?
Could have been.
I mean, if they were coming at me at 180 and one little thing happened, who's dying and how many people?
They're 2 miles down the road. Now they're here.
That's like exactly
one second,
right. You know? That's exactly right. And, you know, it's kind of like the drag racing. I mean, I prosecuted, sure, a lot of cases, you know, that end up, they think it's fun,
right,
they think it's glamorous,
it's,
and somebody ends up,
here,
because it happens so easily.
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize how easy, when you're at those high speeds, for somebody to die. So, and I think it's lasted for 40 years because they stayed under the radar, mm-hmm, no pun intended. They kept quiet about
literally,
it.
Literally, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That secrecy was for many reasons.
I wonder whether some of these other racers are pissed off at
I'm
him for,
sure they
you
are.
Know, you violated the code here, bro.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because, like they said, you know, they're worried about copycats. Absolutely, because this guy got all of this attention. It went international. I mean, you know, London and, you know, Germany, Croatia, Australia, they were, yeah, all reporting it. And then he goes on CBS Saturday Morning and Inside Edition, and all the TV people want to talk
TV
to him. Right. How stupid is he?
Mm-hmm.
So, but here's the problem for the prosecution. You have the confessions, essentially, because he's talking about it, right?
You have the printout here that has been published by Road and Track that has,
yeah,
all this digital data on it, which,
yes,
by the way, you have a digital trail,
yeah,
on your car that says, I did this.
Yeah, yeah. And you've been saying, I did it. I was the one driving. So is there a case? You can't do it just based on a confession. You've got to have this other stuff to support it, because anybody can come in and confess to a crime. That's not enough, because some people do. It's crazy, but,
mm-hmm,
they do.
Right.
So, but having things like this, and there's video out there. And they even said they hold on to the video for a year because they don't want, you know, a statute of limitations issue. So I'm sure there's video out there, surveillance video, security cameras that probably caught this. So, yes, a prosecutor could probably dig into this and go after them. Would they? Probably not, except now there seems to be like they need to make a statement.
Because it's so blatant.
Because it's so blatant and so dangerous.
It almost seems like this guy's trying to, you know, by the way, no disrespect police, no disrespect prosecutors. I realize what I said. I'm sorry about putting this red flag out here.
Yeah.
Gosh, please don't throw the book at me.
Yeah. Like, I'm never going to do it again.
Public statements. Yeah. He says, I'm never going to do it. Yeah. I don't even care if somebody breaks my record. But it's true, you know, despite all these meticulous planning and high tech and spending thousands and thousands of dollars to do this, it's still, it could have, you know, within those 27 hours going that fast, one little minor miscalculation, you might have destroyed yourselves and driven off a cliff or driven in a ditch and flipped your car or whatever, mm-hmm. but someone else. So absolutely about as dangerous as, I mean, you know, I'm getting up in my age, but when I'm on the freeway and somebody goes by me, like I'm standing still, that is like, I'm like, you jerk.
Exactly.
Like, I hope there's a cop somebody.
I hope somebody stops
somebody,
you.
Somebody please do this because, you know, you are going to hurt somebody. Yeah. You know, I mean, definitely in LA County, we're exposed to that quite a bit with all these roadways and just some bad drivers. Also, just out of curiosity, this isn't quite related, but I'm just curious about this. I see this a lot in California. I haven't noticed so many other places that cars will drive around with their paper plates, like the dealer plates and things like that.
Yeah.
I have a friend that has a high-end Lotus, and he does the same thing. And I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, but I'm pretty sure it's like, you can't get me if I run a red light or if I'm speeding or whatever in a traffic camera. I have a red Lotus. It's basically nondescript because if I don't have a license plate on it,
yeah.
And yet I don't see too many people getting pulled over. I've gotten pulled over for an expired tag, for Christ's sake,
yeah.
And versus the paper thing. So, is there an official stance on that or an unofficial thing, LA County wise?
I don't know what the policy is now. I mean, the other thing too is some cars don't have like a front license plate thing, and you can get cited for that too, but.
Right.
Not very often. I mean, it doesn't happen that often. So
right. There
are things that police officers can cite you for.
It's not necessarily always worth your time
right.
to, you know, I could be doing other things or responding to other things. On the other hand, though, and, you know, I've worked at a local news station in town here before and seen more than my share of high-speed police pursuits of these vehicles. And occasionally they'll get away with it because, you know, they'll ditch the car. They'll manage to drive so crazy that they have to pull back and whatever, but they don't have any... One of the drawbacks of following police pursuits is that we don't always get the follow-up. I mean, it might be a week later or something like that they figure out, you know, this identifying characteristic of this car and then go after somebody at their house or whatever else. But that's just a personal thing. It drives me crazy when I see those paper plates in town. I'm like, I'm playing by the rules. Well, you have a $1 million car here. What's your deal, man? But I feel like that's the thing. Exactly. I mean, you know, pick my battles. Anyway, so yeah, we'll look forward to hearing more from Doug Tabbitt and the gang on that one. But don't speed. Don't be a jerk in traffic. So we get comments on a lot of our stories on truecrimedaily.com and our various social media channels. We run a lot of stories, and this one in particular this week, speaking of driving, bad drivers, et cetera, I'll describe this for our listeners. We've got a woman who was arrested on suspicion of DUI after she got her RV stuck in the wrong end of a Taco Bell drive-thru. if you can't see this, there's a do not enter sign and of course, the arrow pointing outwards in the drive-thru of this of this Taco Bell and this giant RV. This is it's a pretty nice one. Looks
it's
modern.
Big.
It's big and long. The female driver here allegedly drove in the wrong way and took this corner, and they are kind of wedged in this narrow space here. So not only did they get wedged in there, but they went in the wrong way, and she got arrested for DUI. So some of our commenters, of course, Jacqueline V says, must have been Taco Tuesday. Sharon K says she may be just tired. Well, Sharon, she was actually charged with DUI, and police don't do that lightly. So, you know, it was the field test and blood alcohol, et cetera, and so forth. And maybe she was also tired, but poor decision making, and don't drive drunk, especially a giant vehicle like this. And then Andrew M says what probably a lot of people are thinking. I'd have been so pissed if I was next in line and this monstrosity pulled around the corner the wrong way. yeah, don't do it. Lots of late night Taco Bell runs, but make sure you're not driving drunk.
That's right.
And you're following the rules. And signs matter, especially that blatant, big do not enter sign, drive through exit.
Do not keep the Taco Bell fans from their tacos.
I sympathize. I haven't had Taco Bell in a long time.
It's good though, right?
It is so satisfying.
Sauce, that crunch?
Yeah. A couple times a year it hits the spot. Well, that is our show for this week. Lonnie, thank you for being here once again.
Thanks for having me.
Where can viewers and listeners kind of find out more about what you're up to? Is it the Oxygen channel?
Yeah, Oxygen channel. And I'm on Instagram and Twitter, Lonnie Coombs.
Gotcha. Well, thank you again for being here. Of course, we'll include your details in descriptions of the podcast and the video. Find our content on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and on YouTube, and get updates and subscribe to our newsletter at truecrimedaily.com. Until next week, this is True Crime Daily, the podcast, reminding you, don't do crimes.